This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Big week in politics. Donald Trump held his first news conference as president-elect. He denied his campaign worked with the Russians, whose alleged email hacking may have helped him get elected. He slammed media outlets for churning out fake news. And he said he wouldn't divest himself of his business interests, but that that would not create a conflict of interest. Our guest today will help us break down the news from Washington and North Carolina. Jeff Bennett is a Time Warner Cable News Washington reporter. Jeff Bennett, welcome back.
Good to be with you.
Ken Rudin, our political junkie. How are you doing, Ken?
How are you, Frank?
I'm fine. Let me start with you and ask you what your take on this news conference was, the first since the election for the president-elect.
Well, you know, it was, of course, let's not forget it came just a couple of hours after President Obama had his farewell address. And the difference in tone between the outgoing president and the incoming president was just remarkable. The attacks, as you point out, on the press, the attacks on the intelligence agencies, the attacks basically still on Hillary Clinton. There were so many references to Hillary Clinton, how she couldn't do what he's able to do. The campaign, as far as I know, ended in November, or maybe it went on a little longer than it should have because of recounts and things like that. But the Electoral College vote made it official, and the inauguration will make it official. But he doesn't forget his enemies, that's for sure.
No, and so speaking of enemies, the former enemy, the Soviet Union, now the Russians, Jeff Bennett, let's start with that, because that, of course, a big topic of conversation. So uncorroborated dossier comes out indicating that the Russians have a lot on Donald Trump. Then they weren't only hacking the Democrats, and this was cause for concern. How did he handle that?
Right. And CNN broke that story. And then immediately after that, BuzzFeed News decided to publish the unverified dossier on Trump that had been swirling around Washington for weeks. And so what we saw from the president-elect was that he and Sean Spicer, his soon-to-be White House press secretary, conflated the two stories. CNN's reporting of the fact that this document existed, that the president and president-elect had been briefed on it, and then but also the details contained in that document itself. And so, as you said, he refused to take a question from a CNN reporter. He slammed it all as fake news. But the underlying fact here is that, one, we still don't know whether Trump's campaign encouraged Russia's alleged hacking to hurt Hillary Clinton. We don't know if they had any dealings during the campaign. Trump finally conceded that news conference that he said, as far as hacking, I think it was Russia. But then he also said it could have been China. It could have been some guy in the basement. He said he has no business dealings with Russia, no loans with Russia. Of course, we don't know that to be true because he has not released his tax returns. So, yeah, there are many unanswered questions about the president-elect, his campaign, and what the ties might exist
with
the Russian government.
A lot of unanswered questions about some very serious questions about his legitimacy, about whether or not a foreign power helped him in office with his support. Very serious questions that could hobble him or at least follow him through his presidency. And here's what he did when he got the question at a news conference.
As far as hacking, I think it was Russia, but I think we also get hacked by other countries and other people. And I can say that, you know, when we lost 22 million names and everything else that was hacked recently, they didn't make a big deal out of that. That was something that was extraordinary. That was probably China.
So here he is pointing us to a different story, not the one regarding whether or not his campaign was complicit with the Russians in hacking and possibly supporting his campaign. But then when, as you said, Jeff, the CNN reporter wanted to ask a question, here's what we get.
Go ahead. Go ahead. No, not you. Not you. Your organization's terrible. Your organization's terrible. Let's go. Go ahead. Quiet. Quiet. Go ahead. She's asking a question. Don't be rude. Don't be rude. Don't be rude. No, I'm not going to give you a question. I'm not going to give you a question. You are fake news. Go ahead.
That is the president-elect of the United States of America. Jeff Bennett, what was happening there?
So Jim Acosta, the reporter with CNN who was in the front row, was asking or attempted to ask Donald Trump a question, and then you heard the response. Jim Acosta later said that Sean Spicer threatened to have him removed from the room, and I think something to the effect of, if you ever do that again, you won't be allowed to come to any more press conferences. Of course, that's not how democracy works. Journalism is protected. The free press is protected in the Constitution. But, you know, what's really interesting about this, Frank, was that I was speaking with a congressional source who has direct knowledge of the intelligence community's consideration of all this. And this person said that what we're seeing is the process of intelligence gathering thrown out into the public. And this is really without precedent. And that if people hadn't known before, they do know now that the U.S. government has a number of intelligence agencies, each has their own mission. And then that all sorts of all floats up to the director of national intelligence, James Clapper. So when James Clapper himself comes out and says, "We have high confidence in this Russian operation," that is major. And it's also tectonic that the president-elect would publicly disparage it or you know, give some indication that he doesn't think it's all on the level. And that, you know, the agencies would not have briefed President Obama, Vice President Biden, and President-elect Donald Trump were it not for the overwhelming data and analysis that exists. And for that matter, we heard Kellyanne Conway dispute the fact that the president-elect had been briefed on this. And now we, of course, know from some reporting that the FBI Director James Comey briefed the president-elect last Friday in person.
Yeah. So clearly they were they misspoke on that fact. So when it comes to fake news, we're not sure who's faking the news and who's not. But Ken, we're also these are, again, very serious allegations. And as Jeff Bennett points out, these are pretty credible in terms of the fact that, you know, in terms of what we understand about who made these allegations, who found the intelligence, and who was briefed. And we understand that not only are we going to look into that, the possibility that this might be true, that the Russians have something on our president, but also how the information got to the press. So we're going to have a two-front war and start to accuse the messenger. Tell us about Senate Intelligence Committee, Ken.
Well, see, that's exactly what the president seems to be doing. Not only is he delegitimizing the media, but he's also doing the same thing to the intelligence agencies. I always found it interesting that when FBI Director Comey came out with his at least the WikiLeaks hacks and things like that came out about Hillary Clinton, he welcomed it. Matter of fact, in the press conference, I thought this was one of the more interesting things, that he said, you know, hacking is really bad. It's really, really bad. But let me tell you all this juicy stuff we found out about Hillary Clinton. So when it's directed at Donald Trump, it's clear to him that it's wrong and it's dishonest and a crime. When it's leaks about other people or his adversaries, he just seems to welcome it. And I thought it was also interesting, speaking of things that are interesting, when FBI Director Comey was asked about whether what he feels about the investigation into these leaks about Donald Trump, he says, "I am not going to comment on an ongoing investigation," which is exactly what he did with Hillary Clinton. And now the Inspector General is investigating Comey's decision to do so, to see if there was some kind of improper nefarious work there. So there's so many questions. And one of the things I also thought was fascinating was that so many of the reporters stood up at that press conference and had multi-level questions, multi-number questions, like four or five questions. And so Donald Trump, who was no slouch in dealing with the press, knew exactly that he would answer the ones he wanted to answer and ignore the ones he didn't want to answer. And I think reporters need to be much more disciplined in the future if future press conferences will be allowed.
It's interesting to think about these investigations, as you say, surrounding intelligence reports going forward, because Jeff Bennett, let me ask you, the Senate Intelligence Committee, chaired by Richard Burr of North Carolina, is going to look into how these leaks got out. That might have a chilling effect on the legitimate press. Meanwhile, you've got the Russians who are leaking information and who have unfettered access. And so what you're going to get, I suppose, is a possible chilling effect on real news. And then you'll have the Russians, I suppose, and others who have access, as I say, unfettered access, releasing selected information. As we know, Vladimir Putin was definitely hoping that Donald Trump would be elected and was working to see that happened. Whether or not it was complicit with the campaign, we still don't know. But that does leave an interesting possibility of a chilling effect on legitimate news organizations while rogue organizations have unfettered access to the story. Tell us about the Senate Intelligence Committee investigation.
And also to your point, if the Russians' end goal was to create was to disseminate disinformation to create chaos, well then they've essentially already already succeeded. But the Senate Intelligence Investigation, as you said, will kick off shortly, and it could be that some of the campaign staffers for Donald Trump's presidential campaign could be called to account to talk about what they knew or if they know anything and when and were they in cahoots with the Russian government as this hacking unfolded. And I should also say, I was also speaking to an intelligence practitioner for 20 years who was saying that the timing of the leaks was also in itself interesting. One, because it could have been leaked to the media. The fact that this the dossier existed and all of that could have been leaked to remove Russia's leverage such that it even existed. But it also could have been leaked to box in Donald Trump before he takes office, should he want to do some sort of major reset that could not maybe not be in line with, you know, the goals of the American state, that by releasing all of this information at the forefront would sort of limit his ability to make some decisions on his own when he comes into office.
All right, we're going to take a break right here. When we come back, lots more to talk about conflict of interest. We'll take a look at Obamacare, what it means nationally, and also here in the state of North Carolina. Jeff Bennett, Time Warner Cable News Washington reporter Ken Rudin, political junkie. Both will stay with us. We'll be joined by Jeff Tiberi, our State House Capitol Bureau Chief. All of that on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio, taking a look back at the week in politics with a political roundtable today. We've got two Jeffs and a Ken on the show. Jeff Bennett is Time Warner Cable News Washington reporter. Jeff Tiberi is here, our WNC Capitol Bureau Chief. Jeff Tiberi, welcome.
Hello. Glad to be here.
Yeah, and Ken Rudin, our political junkie, here as well. Ken, let me get your take on what we were talking about a minute ago, the idea that part of the emphasis on this intelligence gathering and the whole intelligence scandal that's brewing in Washington might focus on the media. What's your take on that and the impact it might have?
Well, I'm not exactly sure on your question how the media would respond and deal with intelligence leaks. Is that what you're asking?
Well, yeah. I mean, if it turns out that there's going to be punishment meted out for, you know, talking to the media, you know, what kind of effect does that have on news gathering going forward?
Oh, there was an absolute chill. I mean, I came away from there were so many things I came away from that press conference, and I just so many thoughts. I mean, the ultimate thought is that when Donald Trump was asked about his tax returns, he says, well, you know, only you guys are the ones who care about it. And then he said, besides, I won. And I have a feeling that I won will be his answer to any kind of scandal or question mark that approaches him. But it's clear that the effect, the way he sees the media, how he regards the Second Amendment, the First Amendment, is just remarkable. I mean, we've seen, look, we all know about Richard Nixon's enemies list, and we know that Obama, early in his administration, was really questioning whether Fox News was really truly a news organization, and he was barring it from his officials appearing on the network. But this is a hostility that is less about ideology and more about just personal pique that I think that when Jim Acosta, and Jeff was talking about this earlier, when Jim Acosta was shouted down by the president, president-elect, over and over again, ignoring to refusing to take questions from the CNN, that fake news operation, at some point I suspect that the media or the reporters who attend these events will have to come up with some kind of a plan, as opposed to just sitting by and letting the president-elect just rip apart CNN. I mean, tomorrow could be MSNBC News, MSNBC. It could be CBS News. It could be anything. So it could be NPR. So I kind of think that there needs to be some kind of a strategy by the reporters, by those who attend these press conferences, saying that we regard this attack on one member station or on one network as attack on all of us, and some response needs to happen.
Well, one of the things those news media organizations will be covering is conflict of interest. Donald Trump says he will not divest himself of his business interest, but he says, Jeff Bennett, it's not going to be a conflict of interest. He's come up with a plan. Tell us about that.
And he also said that as president, he would have no conflicts of interest. Exactly. But he's doing this because he wanted to avoid the appearance of a conflict. But, you know, he's promising that he and his adult sons won't talk business or policy, you know, while he runs the country and they run his company. But we'll have to take his word on it. And what was interesting about that was that during the conventions. That was sort of the thrust of his speech was, you know, I alone can fix the country's problems, and you have to trust that I know what I'm doing, and I have a business record, and I can do this. And now he's asking the country to trust that he will not violate these conflicts of interests. And he says his company is hiring an ethics officer to review any new deals. And I should point out that at that press conference, he had stacks of manila folders filled with papers, but none of the reporters were able to actually open those folders and see what was in them. So we're not entirely sure if that was a prop or if there was anything substantive in there.
The envelope, please. It might also be pointed out that while he won't, the two children who will inherit his wealth will be doing the business and carry his name. I mean, there is that possibility. Ken Rudin, this is unprecedented as well. I mean, the families, often presidents happen to come from wealthy families very often, and they divest themselves, put their money into a blind trust. Donald Trump is not unprecedented, right?
It is unprecedented. I mean, first of all, it was interesting when we heard his personal tax attorney saying, well, you know, Nelson Rockefeller went through this when he was vice president, but nobody cared. Well, that was the objection to Nelson Rockefeller, how to divest and how to separate his fortune from his duties. But he did so. He made sure to do so in that brief time he was vice president in 1973 and 1974. But Donald Trump, basically, I mean, the fact that he says he separated himself from his industry, one, I thought it was interesting. There was one bit of when he was talking, he stumbled over the word country. He said company, and then he said country,
yeah,
as if he doesn't know the difference. And two, the people who he's going to be separated from stood 10 feet from him on the platform. So how much of a separation is that?
They will inherit his wealth. So, you know, it's inherently it's their money, right? I mean, so there, I don't understand where the separation is at all. And I think that's going to be the critique going forward. But it's quite interesting. Jeff Bennett, let me ask you this question, whether or not that matters. Donald Trump won, and he's going to say that over and over again, and he's going to move forward with this. If there were a conflict of interest and it rose to the level of congressional attention, would there be an investigation? Who would investigate him?
I don't know that if there would be an investigation as long as there's a Republican-controlled Congress. But I will say that it matters because it has to matter, right? this whole system, the system that he set up for his companies, I mean, it depends almost entirely on him and his team following their own rules with an almost total absence of public disclosure or outside oversight. And his whole sort of self-verification system has drawn criticism from both parties, from independent, you know, observers. So, outside of the political context, substantively, yes, it matters. And I would hope that there will be people within the government to hold him to account.
Switch gears a little bit. Obamacare, the first attack on Obamacare launched in Congress. Jeff Bennett, let me stick with you and talk a little bit about the effort to undo the Affordable Care Act.
Yeah, so the Senate took the first major step yesterday morning. Well, started Wednesday evening and ended around Thursday morning, 1:30 in the morning. And so the vote itself doesn't repeal the Affordable Care Act, but it sets the stage for Republicans to clear the first procedural hurdle. And then it heads to the House, and the House is going to vote today, if they have not voted already, to continue this budget process of dismantling the law. Now, we heard the president-elect say that the repeal and the replacement could take effect, he said, the same week, the same day, potentially the same hour. It does not appear that it'll happen that quickly, that simultaneously. House Speaker Paul Ryan says he doesn't quite yet have a timeline of when this replacement bill will end up on the president's desk. And the reason for that is because even though Republicans have several ideas, there is no one consensus bill. Now, Trump says that his incoming director of Health and Human Services, Tom Price, that the bill that Tom Price has written will be the starting point. Republicans across the field aren't convinced that that's the case. So, you know, the Republicans writ large are aware of the political risks here, and they're taking their time, partly because they don't want to be responsible for potentially having 30 million people who the government says got health insurance under Obamacare not having it for whatever period of time, but also because they don't yet have a clear vision. And the parallel here is stunning because, you know, you remember President Obama's first term was consumed by health care at the detriment of everything else. And now we have Donald Trump coming into office focused on health care, potentially at the detriment of everything else. So.
But what you talked about was Republicans realizing that millions of people have been helped by this. If you just pull the rug out, there's going to be a lot of angry Americans who will suddenly have no health care. They have to come up with something. They don't have it. What's interesting to me, Jeff Bennett, I want to stick with you for a minute, is that the biggest cry for a pause in this process of undoing Obamacare comes from the right, the Freedom Caucus, led now by Mark Meadows of North Carolina. Tell us more.
That's right. And Mark Meadows, if people don't know, he was the mastermind that got the process started for former House Speaker John Boehner to start eyeing the exits and go into early retirement. And that was because Meadows believed that Boehner didn't hold closely enough to true conservative values. And so and the congressman that I've interviewed him, he's adamant that not only should this replacement and the repeal happen around the same time, but that the entire thing needs to be done within this next Congress, within 2 years and not 3 years, as some other of Republicans would like to do it. So he has the votes. He has about 40 to 50, maybe upwards of 60 members in the sort of far right conservative Freedom Caucus. The group is, as far as I know, doesn't really publish the list of their members because it can change. And also, I think they like the sort of having the cloak of secrecy.
Yeah.
This is definitely an issue where Trump's going to have to sort of whip this bill on his own.
Ken Rudin, what do you make of this? Freedom Caucus was trouble for the, for Republicans, or at least mainstream Republicans in the last administration. I'm not talking about the presidential administration, but for Republicans in control of Congress. What happens with the Freedom Caucus and the Trump administration? How do you see things moving forward?
Well, you know, that's also a good question, because from the moment they took control of Congress after the House, after 2010, these Republicans were elected on repealing Obamacare. Now, of course, Boehner, to his credit, but of course nobody gave him credit for it, he said, well, we can have all the votes we want, but we're not going to get rid of Obamacare when there's a guy named Obama in the White House. So we won't have a guy named Obama starting January 20th. But the fact is, we've been talking, Republicans have been talking about repeal and replace for at least 6 years now. They've been elected and reelected on this plan. And the fact that Jeff says that they still don't have a plan after all this time, now that they've taken complete power, the White House, both houses of Congress, is pretty remarkable. But the fact that Donald Trump, when he campaigned on repeal and replace, he did say, well, I do kind of like the thing about pre-existing conditions. You can't deny somebody coverage with pre-existing conditions. You can't deny kids under 26 years old can be on their parent plan. He liked that as well. But both of those seem to be wiped out if they're going to completely get rid of the Affordable Care Act as it now stands.
Well, at the national level, Republicans trying to get rid of Obamacare here in the state of North Carolina. The elections brought a Democratic governor into the governor's mansion, and that means welcoming the ACA and expanding Medicaid, at least for the next couple of minutes. Jeff DeBerry, WNC Capital Bureau Chief, tell us about that.
Or at least trying to,
mm-hmm.
Right? So Democratic Governor Roy Cooper is in office, and one of the first things that he did last week was seek an amendment to expand Medicaid here in the state, which originally was something under the Affordable Care Act that governors were required to do. Then a legal challenge came from a couple dozen states. John Roberts penned the opinion that altered that so governors could opt in. And as we've talked about here on the program before, there are several notable Republican governors who did opt into Medicaid expansion. Jan Brewer of Arizona, the soon-to-be vice president, Mike Pence of Indiana, Ohio, and also New Jersey, with Chris Christie in New Jersey, John Kasich in Ohio, who expanded Medicaid. That did not happen here. Republican lawmakers went so far 4 years ago as to pass a law saying that the governor was not allowed to expand Medicaid. And that's, to some extent, what the fight is going to center on moving forward. Roy Cooper contends that this is part of his core function, his responsibilities, his abilities as executive of the state, and he should be able to expand Medicaid unilaterally, so to speak, if he wants to. Republicans have said this is just not under his purview. It is illegal. So what we may see, should stress, we don't know if we will see this, what we may see in the next week is the federal government rubber stamping this effort to send Medicaid expansion forward here. If that happens, the expectation is that lawyers with Speaker Pro Tem Phil Berger and House Speaker Tim Moore will most likely grind this thing to a halt, potentially by the time Donald Trump takes office. And Medicaid expansion here under this proposal, this effort, is a long shot.
And particularly if the program itself, although it would take a while to wind down, if it got started here in North Carolina, talking about 500,000 North Carolinians without coverage right now, owing to the fact that this state refused to expand Medicaid. And then, of course, the other question is, it could result in yet another lawsuit, and we may have to devote half of our budget just to fighting the lawsuits against the state legislature for some of the bills that they passed in recent memory.
I would not lay too many specifics on the table for what we expect to see during the long legislative session, which ceremonially began this week, will extend into July. I would put money on the table, however, that we will see more lawsuits between Republican, the leadership in the General Assembly, and or the Executive Mansion or the Attorney General's office. Josh Stein, a former state senator, Democrat, now the Attorney General, replaces Roy Cooper. The courts will be a way that these two bodies continue to fight over separation of powers and who gets to do what around Raleigh.
Let me stay here in North Carolina for just another second and talk about the relationship and the possibility of compromise between this Democratic governor and a veto-proof, we should point out, state legislature.
It's going to be interesting. It really, truly is, because Republicans at the General Assembly have veto-proof majorities. They do not need necessarily to work with Governor Cooper on many things. At the same time, it's a totally different relationship. If we think about how it's been the last 4 years, yes, there was a Republican in the Executive Mansion. And with due respect to Governor McCrory and some of the things, some of the initiatives, bond initiatives and efforts that he was able to push through, he didn't ever build great relationships or great bonds with the legislature. They treated him as somewhat of an afterthought. They did not need him to get things done. Now it's a little bit different of a dynamic in that, A, you're dealing with a Democrat in Roy Cooper, and B, this is an official who has been in Raleigh for 30 years. He spent time in the House and Senate, 16 years as Attorney General. He's worked now in all three chambers of government, so he understands how the apparatus works. Now, is that going to make him an effective leader, an effective governor? We don't know yet.
We have an experienced politician making his way into public office in the Executive Mansion, and another experienced executive leaving Jeff Bennett. President Obama made his farewell address. Give us your take on President Obama saying goodbye after 8 years.
Well, it's funny. I spoke with the White House Communications Director, Jen Psaki, before the speech, and she was adamant that he would not mention Donald Trump during the speech. And he didn't, but he definitely mentioned Trump obliquely. And the greatest applause line in that speech was where he talked about, this country is not a country that should target Muslims. And that's not something that an outgoing president would include in a farewell address unless he thought that he had to. We heard that warning. There are also warnings about the fact that if we don't come together and sort of come out of our own hives on social media, that it could, lead to the undoing of the democracy. What I also thought was particularly noteworthy was the fact that he said that the talk of him taking office in a post-racial America was sort of unfounded and silly. And then the coda at the end where he said, yes, we can. Yes, we did. Yes, we can. Going back to the rallying call of his campaign, and then looking forward as if to say, yes, we can do all of these other things we have to achieve if we just come together. It was a remarkable speech given by a man who's given similar speeches, and one of the reasons why he was elected in the first place was his ability to deliver in that realm in an effective way. And then, there was the things that he said about his wife, and he grew teary-eyed as he mentioned the fact that Michelle Obama had taken this job that she didn't ask for and had done a remarkable job as First Lady.
Ken Rudin, you heard that speech. What did you make of it?
Well, I thought the thing that struck me the most, and it hit me almost immediately, is when he started to say, maybe 10 minutes into the speech, you start to say that in 10 days there's going to be a transfer of power, and then the audience started to boo. I mean, there was no reference, no mention of Donald Trump, but everybody knew what he was talking about. And then President Obama would have none of it. He said, no, this is exactly what we do, the kind of transition, the great transition that I got from my predecessor, George W. Bush. I promised the incoming president the same thing. And when I think of Barack Obama tamping down the booing at the suggestion of Donald Trump, I just immediately go to when whenever Donald Trump would give a speech and he'd mention Hillary Clinton, and the audience would say, lock her up, and he would encourage it and encourage the violence. So the difference in styles and demeanors between the two former, soon-to-be former president and the soon-to-be new president could not be more dramatic than that moment.
No, and perhaps illustrated in this clip from the president's speech on international affairs.
If the scope of freedom and respect for the rule of law shrinks around the world, the likelihood of war within and between nations increases, and our own freedoms will eventually be threatened. So let's be vigilant, but not afraid. ISIL will try to kill innocent people, but they cannot defeat America unless we betray our Constitution and our principles in the fight. Rivals like Russia or China cannot match our influence around the world unless we give up what we stand for and turn ourselves into just another big country that bullies smaller neighbors.
President Barack Obama in his farewell address talking about the role of the United States moving forward. I want to thank all of my guests today, Jeff Bennett, a Time Warner Cable News Washington reporter, Ken Rudin, our political junkie, Jeff DeBerry, WNC's Capital Bureau Chief. Thank you all for being on the program.
Enjoy.
Thanks, guys.
Just ahead, a preview of a cabaret show that tells a dystopian fantasy story to the soundtrack of rock and roll classics. Stay tuned.